Okay, today we are going to finish, Lord willing, our discussion of backgrounds and talk a little bit about crucifixion in the ancient world as a means of talking about backgrounds. These things are on your sheet, again, on basic Bible backgrounds. And I'm interested in you being able to define these four different Jewish sects. Now, this is maybe not an exclusive list. There might have been other sects, in fact, there were in Judaism in the first century. But these are the four that Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, outlines for us. He says that there are four, and he calls them philosophies. Okay? Now, the philosophy term is probably one, in order to be able to convey to his largely Gentile audience what it means to have four different perspectives on ancient Judaism. But it's also interesting that in using the philosophy term, he is tying into the rich tradition of philosophy in pagan antiquity. He also describes them primarily in terms of the main definition that he gives has to do with predestination and free will. Actually, I would say more strictly speaking, determinism and free will. And roughly speaking, the Sadducees believe in a radical free will for human beings. The Essenes are highly deterministic. And the Pharisees are somewhere in between, seeing room both for the free will of human beings and for the determining aspect of God. Okay? Now, when I say, for instance, that they are deterministic, I don't mean that in the same sense that a Reformed teacher would use the term predestination, per se. Okay? Very rigorous determinism. You cannot thwart the purposes of God, and therefore every step is highly determined. Besides those kind of key definitions that Josephus gives of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes, there's some other important qualifications about them. The Sadducees, in addition to being believing in free will, tended to be the kind of ancient Jewish power elite. Okay, so they were the ones who were typically most connected politically and connected with the power base of the high priesthood. Okay, so typically we associate them in that regard. The other aspect that is crucial about them, and Josephus verifies this for us, and it's also stated in the New Testament, is that the Sadducees rejected the idea of the resurrection, and Josephus also adds that they rejected oral tradition. So in beyond the canon, there was oral teaching that was kind of a set of precedents and ancient rabbinic sayings by these wonderful rabbinic forebearers of the first century Jewish rabbis that were passed down and were viewed to be a kind of almost second law. It is striking that some rabbinic documents trace oral rabbinic law back to Moses himself. Okay, and there is seen to be a kind of succession of rabbis who stand in the seat of Moses, or sit in the seat of Moses. I guess you sit in the seat, don't you? Right? And that's a phrase that's actually used in the New Testament. All right. And so this would be the oral tradition. Well, the Sadducees did not accept this to the same degree that the Pharisees did. So the Pharisees, when they approach the Old Testament, are interpreting the Old Testament, but they're also inclined to interpret it in light of the traditional rabbinic understanding of the Old Testament. And also kind of legal case law, if you would. So the Sadducees rejected that, whereas the Pharisees are in that mode of being rabbinic teachers. Okay, and the rabbis themselves, after the destruction of the temple, at the formation of the Mishnah, when was the Mishnah formulated? Do you remember? AD 200, very good. That's one of those dates that you're supposed to know. AD 200. So basically a couple centuries after the time of Jesus, the rabbis themselves traced their tradition back to the Pharisees. Okay. So that's why rabbinic teaching is often used to determine what the Pharisees likely said. There's something somewhat dubious about that. Because if you go 200 years after somebody actually lived and try and trace back those thoughts, sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't know for sure because it's 200 years later. So a lot of times things that are said in pulpits about Pharisees are actually based on rabbinic teaching that came a few centuries later, and you have to be careful with that. Much more optimal is if you can trace what we know about Pharisees in the first century through Josephus and others to some of that rabbinic legislation and see degrees of continuity, then you're a lot safer saying the Pharisees believe this as opposed to that. Okay? But that's just another issue. The point, though, is that the Pharisees ultimately, it was from the fount of the Pharisees that full rabbinic teaching drew its well of resources. The Essenes were described by Josephus as being highly deterministic and also having strong monastic tendencies. There was a strong contingency among the Essenes who did not marry. Though Josephus is also careful to note that some Essenes did marry. So this is a largely celibate sect as far as Josephus describes it, and very monastic in that regard. Now, there has in the last... now it's been about 60 years, been found a storehouse of scrolls near a Jewish settlement which is known as Qumran. And those are known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Right. There has been a good deal of debate about whether those scrolls actually represent Essenism, but they do fit the approximate locale that Pliny describes. He's a pagan author, but he describes location of different groups, and he describes the Essenes as being out in the desert, and Qumran's roughly in the right area. And the scrolls have a number of points of specific contact with what we know about the Essene sect, though there are also some very troubling passages in making a one-for-one connection. Major one being that most of the documents at Qumran, when they speak of marriage or celibacy, typically assume marriage. And so this doesn't jive wholly well with the celibacy that you see in Josephus. There have been various attempts at resolving that, and I think it's still the most likely at this stage, although the evidence is continuing to be evaluated, that the Qumran materials, the Dead Sea Scrolls from Qumran, are connected with the Essenes. There are, by the way, Dead Sea Scrolls not found at Qumran. Those would have a different provenance, likely, but there's that. Okay. So the three major sects that Josephus spends the bulk of his time describing, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. He also admits to a fourth philosophy that he never quite names. But these seem to be people who are interested in regaining political control of Judea for the Jewish people themselves. So effectively overthrowing pagan rule, as I mentioned here. And these can be subdivided, again using some terms that you find in Josephus, into the Zealots and the Sicarii. Now, the Zealots were probably a wide-ranging group of people. It's not like there was this one kind of Zealot movement that had this one, you know, kind of, they had their charter that described what a Zealot was. It was actually probably a variety of movements within Judaism in the time, all of which shared the notion of wanting to see pagan rule overthrown and the kingdom returned to the Jewish people. Whereas the Sicarii were ancient assassins. The term sicari actually refers to the knives that they carried. And so the way that they would work is they would be walking along in a crowded place in Jerusalem, and maybe they'd come across one of the supporters of the Roman power elite, say, I don't know, a high priest. And they'd slip out their dagger, and they'd keep walking. That's what the sicari would do. And there was a famous instance of a high priest who was actually assassinated because of his ties to the Roman rule. All right. So the fourth philosophy is probably not, again, this one group of people that all agreed on how they should overthrow pagan rule, but they were generally agreed on the need to do so. And it's possible that one of the reasons that Josephus soft-pedals this group is, again, he's writing after the Jewish War, in the pay of emperors, Titus and Vespasian, in order to make a bit of an apologetic for his own Jewish people and his Jewish nation. And he's trying to say that, you know, this wasn't an overwhelming movement. This was just a few hotheads who wanted to overthrow pagan rule, and a lot of people got caught up in it, and that's why we had this revolt. So he's trying to isolate and keep all of Judaism from being tainted with this idea of being a revolutionary religion, if you would. So, four groups. Now, you should know these, certainly, because the Sadducees and the Pharisees show up in the New Testament. And you'll be aware, for instance, that the Sadducees try and tempt Jesus by challenging him on the resurrection. And Jesus comes back with this wonderful retort in Matthew. And actually, it's repeated in some of the other Gospels as well. So, in Matthew chapter 22, you know, they have this little trap they try and play on Jesus in 22:23. And on that day, some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. Again, that was confirmed by Josephus independently of the New Testament. But they say there's no resurrection. Come to the teacher and question him, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother is next of kin, shall marry his wife and raise up an offspring to his brother." This is the practice known as levirate marriage. Now there, and then he springs the trap. They spring the trap. "There were seven brothers with us, and the first married and died, and having no offspring, left his wife to his next brother." And they go down this whole sequence of brothers, and the question they ask him is, you know, in the resurrection, whose wife will he be? She was married to seven different brothers. Okay, she can't be married to all of them. This would be illegal. So she's got to be married to one. But she was married to all of them in her life. So which is she married in the resurrection? It's this brilliant trap. It is an incredible trap. And then Jesus slips right out of it, telling them that they are mistaken, not understanding the scriptures or the power of God. But then Jesus affirms the resurrection in the midst of all of that. Okay? Now, this idea of the resurrection and the Pharisees supporting it and the Sadducees not is also played up in the end of the book of Acts. When Paul is seized in the temple in Acts chapter 21, and then in 22, when he gives his defense, this comes up again. And he goes to explain this before the council in 23 as well. And he says, "And as he said this, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, for the assembly was divided." What did he say? In chapter 23, verse 6, he says, "Perceiving that one part were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, 'Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.'" And so there's a dissension between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit. But the Pharisees acknowledge them all. "And there arose this great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began arguing heatedly, saying, 'We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him.'" Now the fascinating thing there is, who is rushing to the aid of Paul? The Pharisees. We usually think of the Pharisees as the bad guys, don't we? I mean, this is don't be a Pharisee is our take. But there was something very good about what the Pharisees believed, especially with regard to the resurrection of the dead. And therefore, we should not be surprised that in Acts chapter 15, we find out that there is a large group of Pharisees in the early church. All right? So in Acts chapter 15, we find out that there's this council at Jerusalem, and some men came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them, the brethren determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of the apostles should go up to Jerusalem and the apostles and elders concerning this issue. So this is the debate about circumcision. Now, if you skip to verse 5, but certain ones of the sect of the Pharisees who had believed, that's what the text says, Pharisees who had believed stood up saying, it is necessary to circumcise them and to direct them to observe the law of Moses. Now, Pharisees then being in the early church. Of course, Paul himself was a Pharisee. And so we shouldn't be that surprised that Pharisees are found in the early church and that they especially are attracted to the teaching about the resurrection. Okay? But they also brought in with them some rabbinic baggage, if you would. And it comes up in this very text that it's necessary to circumcise the Gentiles, right? Now, this actually is somewhat of rabbinic baggage, but it also is very Old Testament. And so they had some strong precedent going on here. So this was a major point of anxiety in the early church. And we'll come back to this when we talk about Paul later. But let me just make this point at this stage. Again, backgrounds. What we know from rabbis, from rabbinic teaching, now again, I've got to be careful here because we have clear teaching in this in the rabbinic legislation. And I'm going to try and trace this back to the Pharisees, but I recognize, again, that there's some separation in terms of centuries there. But the rabbis said that if a Gentile wants to become Jewish, you got to do three things. Do you know what the three things are that a Gentile has to do if you want to become Jewish? Circumcision, sure, that's one. What are the other two? Baptism and willingness to take on the law. Rabbinic legislation is so strong in this regard that the rabbi, as the Gentile, is wanting to become a proselyte, wanting to become Jewish, is supposed to try and talk them out of it. And here's the way you talk them out of it. You refer to all the Old Testament legislation that requires death if you don't keep the law in certain respects. Okay? So you say, do you understand that if you do this, we have to put you to death? And if the Gentile says, yes, I understand that. Do you still want to keep the law? Yes. Then you go on to the next one. And you go through this whole series until they are willing to take on the full weight of the law. You baptize them, and you circumcise them. Okay, circumcision having, again, good Old Testament precedent under Moses. Right, and, of course, Abraham himself was called to circumcise, although, as Paul notes, he was called to do so after God had already called him and promised him a legacy. Okay, so Paul is careful to note that sequence there. In any case, if you are a Pharisee and you're sitting there and you're thinking, okay, there's Gentiles coming into the church, we don't have problems with that per se, but here are issues. What are we doing? Well, everybody's agreed that we should baptize. But what are we not doing? We're not circumcising. So we're not doing what we've always done when Gentiles wanted to come into Judaism. Paul's point is, hey, if you circumcise, then they have to keep the whole weight of the law. And no one's been able to do that. Okay? So you see that this isn't just a kind of obtuse discussion that somebody came out and said, and they said, well, we need to circumcise. And Paul said, no way. This was an ongoing debate within Judaism itself that then came into the church. And it probably came in part because of the Pharisees that were in the church in the first century. All right. I'm sorry, before I go on, do you guys have any questions about any of these four philosophies? That's right. Well, there are Old Testament texts that indicate resurrection of the dead. And they focused on those and then anticipated the resurrection of the dead. And we can be thankful that they did because they were correct. Baptism is much more difficult to find in the Old Testament, but it was a rite that was regularly performed. There are a variety of ceremonial washings that Jewish people perform themselves. So if you look at ancient settlements, such as the settlement at Qumran, but also elsewhere, there are these ritual baths that have steps that you actually walk down into, and they're known as mikvayot, that are places where you ceremonially wash yourself in preparation for certain religious practices. So this was something that was done and then was specifically applied to Gentiles as a means of kind of washing off their pagan past in repentance. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, I did say that. The issue there is I said that Paul was worried about them having to keep the full law of Moses, right? The full law of Moses included things like what you can eat and what you can't eat. No pig. So are you going to say that Gentiles have to put off pork, which was a major staple food of Gentiles in the ancient world? Are you saying that, no more crawdads, etc.? So there's the food laws that he was concerned about. There's other aspects of the Mosaic legislation that he was probably concerned about as well. And his point was, if you take on the whole law, then these people cease to become Gentiles. And he wants to allow them to be Gentiles in the midst of it. Now, that is not to say that that's the full perspective of Paul on the law. Paul's concept of the law is very complex in terms of the different purposes of the law. And Paul certainly allowed the law to be the basis for his moral instruction. And the issue is, how did he pick that up? So you don't murder. Why don't you murder? Because God has told us that you don't murder. You don't commit adultery. Why? Because you don't commit adultery. And he's very happy to quote the Decalogue, for instance. And other aspects of the law he also quotes. So he's actually even willing to quote, do not muzzle the ox when it's treading out the grain. And then applies that to church leaders being worthy of their wages. Well, when he does that, what's going on when he picks that up? That's the question that we have going on. I would argue that it's an internalization of the law. The point is if somebody is doing something for the sake of others, they deserve to receive some recompense for it. And so he takes something that primarily was about oxen, and then he applies it more broadly. If you understand him as internalizing aspects of the law, then that goes a long way to understanding how he made moral application of the law, even when he didn't require of Gentiles that they not eat pork, etc. Okay. The reason I use the pork issue is that the issue of meats and what Gentiles can eat was very hot in the ancient church. You see it even with Peter in Acts when he goes to visit Cornelius, the centurion. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so you said he would take on the full law of Moses externally, and that's what he's concerned about. And I would concur with that statement. Yeah. Yeah.
I have two questions. One, in Matthew 23, over and over again, Jesus is pronouncing
woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, etc.
Well, he says over and over, he says, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees.
So right.
Who are the teachers of the law?
We don't have to understand these as exclusively different groups of people. And in the teachers of the law probably was a much broader term that included the Pharisees among their ranks. But not all Pharisees who belonged to the sect of the Pharisees would also consider themselves to be rabbis and to be teachers. So there's probably overlap, but it's not one for one. That would be my quick take. And likewise with the scribes, is not exclusively saying that the scribes are different from the Pharisees. You could have scribes who were Pharisees, but these are two groups of people that overlap. Okay? Does that make some sense?
So the Sadducees?
I could say, let me say, if I, you know, I'm speaking to all of those in this room who are evangelicals and Protestants and Reformed and Baptists. Okay? I can say something like that, and there's overlap between all those groups. Sometimes complete overlap. I mean, evangelicals, almost by definition, are Protestants, although there's some Catholic evangelicals as well. And Baptists and Reformed, that those are not necessarily exclusive, although in our society they're often exclusive. And yet all of those would certainly be under evangelical and Protestants, etc. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, something like that. Were the Sanhedrin primarily... Yeah, the high priest. Were the Sanhedrin primarily Sadducees is a question. We don't know completely the makeup of the Sanhedrin, so it's hard to put percentages on it. But it's probable that the Sanhedrin consisted of both Sadducees and Pharisees. Okay, so you would have members of both sects in there. And by the way, it wasn't exclusive. You didn't necessarily... it wasn't like you were born into one of these categories, right? Josephus says that he tried out each of the major philosophies. And he ended up deciding to be a Pharisee. So Josephus, if we were to accept his word on it, claimed that you could bounce around until you settled into which of these philosophies you agreed with. Now, that's probably the perspective of somebody who was fairly wealthy and had the ability to do that. But nonetheless, that's the take on it. Okay. One last point before we move on. Four philosophies in ancient Judaism. People often ask the following question. Did Jews in the first century believe X? Or did Jews in the first century believe Y? Did Jews in the first century believe that there was a resurrection? Did Jews in the first century believe that Gentiles were all condemned? Did Jews in the first century believe that, you know, whatever it is? That assumes that Judaism was a monolithic entity in the first century. I mean, we can draw some analogies. Contemporary analogies are dangerous, but we can draw some analogies to contemporary Judaism in Israel. You know, does everybody believe that you should have to keep the Sabbath in Israel today? No. I mean, I've been there. I hung out with some Jewish friends, and they were really annoyed. One of them, he said, why don't we get together on Friday and we'll get something to eat? And we got together in the afternoon because I was busy in the morning, and we drove around trying to find something to eat, but every place was closed because the Sabbath was starting. And he was really hacked off. Okay? So there are different views of Judaism today. And those of you who are in contact with Jewish people today will know that there's this constant debate as to what is a Jew. Well, likewise, in some respects, in the first century, there were a variety of takes on Judaism in the first century. So a much more sophisticated way to ask those kind of questions is something like, now, did some Jewish people in the first century believe in the resurrection? And what and who did, and in what respects did they believe in it? You know? So that you're not drawing these big monolithic pictures. Now, there are some uniting elements to Jewish people in antiquity. They all seemed, for instance, to recognize the temple in Jerusalem as kind of the center of their faith and have fond inclinations to that temple. Some believe that it was necessary to go there as regularly as possible to be there present for Jewish religious celebrations. Some couldn't care less. Some hung out in Alexandria, Egypt for the whole time and never bothered to make the trek. But some thought it was very important to do so. So if you think of Judaism in the first century, don't just say, did they all do this? Because usually you're making comments that are wrong, even if there are some uniting elements, ancient Judaism, right? Okay, let's see. There's some other Jewish terms that you should know. These will just hit very quickly. The Herodians were the people who supported the Herodian dynasty. So they were in favor of the Herodian kingly line. And they wanted to see the Jewish monarchy of the Herodians reestablished. And therefore, they were very excited when Agrippa becomes king again in AD 41. very sad when he died in 44. Okay? The Samaritans were that group of people smack dab in between Galilee and Judea, whose lineage is traced back to ancient Israel, not ancient Judah, but ancient Israel. And via the Assyrian exile, the Assyrians practiced exile in a way that was even worse than the Babylonians did, if you would. They not only took Jewish people out, they resettled some of their own kin in the lands that they'd conquered. And so they took the Israelites, the northern kingdom, away, and they resettled others, and they encouraged intermarriage, etc. And so that from the perspective of the Judeans, the people in the southern kingdom, these were no longer true blood Jewish people. Moreover, when the kingdoms divided, there became debates, and ultimately very strong debates, between where the temple properly should be. The southern kingdom thought Jerusalem. No surprise, they're in control over Jerusalem. The northern kingdom, you can imagine, was not so sure about that, and they wanted the temple to be on Mount Gerizim instead. And thus you have, when Jesus approaches the Samaritan woman, there's all these questions about, should the temple be in where we think it is or where you guys think it is? You know, Jewish people, I thought Jewish people and Samaritans didn't have contact, because the Jewish people, a holy Jewish person was to avoid, of course, the Samaritans, because they were impure. Worse, in some respects, than the Gentiles themselves. Now, the Samaritans actually had their own complete religious practice. They accepted the Pentateuch of the Old Testament, but they didn't accept any of the historical books that came after it, because the trajectory of all the historical books lead up to the moving of the temple to Jerusalem and the establishment of the Davidic monarchy, with Judah being especially the right-thinking of the two kingdoms. So they don't accept any of that. So instead, they have the Pentateuch with some revisions, especially revisions that keep pointing out how important Mount Gerizim is. A little surprise there. And then they have their own history of their kingdom. So they had Jewish-looking worship practices that also had some very significant differences. Right? So that's the Samaritans. The last two terms have to do with Gentiles who want to come into Judaism. Proselytes are full-fledged converts. That's the thing that requires circumcision, baptism, and the keeping of the law. God-fearers were people who just liked to show up on the synagogue, and they were interested in Jewish worship practice and found some appeal there, because it was something very different from what they found probably in religious worship in kind of the pagan pantheon, right? The idea of a single deity who created all had some philosophical appeal for people in the first century. That's one thing. Another thing was that this was a religion that was an ethical religion. It taught you how you ought to behave. And remember that most pagan religions did not teach you that. Pagan religions had a lot more to making sure the gods were on your side. And your ethics came from what? Philosophy, exactly. Came from your philosophy. So here was a religion that was also ethical. That held some appeal. And then, frankly, also it was from the East. And Eastern religions were kind of in vogue, you know. So that probably held some appeal there as well. So there were people who would just show up, but they weren't willing to undergo circumcision, baptism, and keeping all the laws. And those would be described as God-fearers. And there are some people who are mentioned as having feared God, Gentiles who feared God in the book of Acts, for instance. And these probably were technically people who were interested in the synagogue and perhaps practiced or participated in synagogue worship practices. Any questions about these categories? I'm speaking in terms of Jewish terms, and a proselyte was technically a Jewish convert. But the Greek word then took up other connotations in Christianity and such. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? All right. Jewish sources, Here, I just basically, don't worry about the Gentile, the pagan sources that are on your sheet. I am interested that you know something about Jewish sources, because these are technical terms that will come up again and again. There are a variety of Jewish translations of the Old Testament. The first two sets here on this list were in Greek, and then Aramaic, Syriac, and then Latin. Of these, you should know that the Old Latin is handily called the Old Latin. All right? So that's not too hard to remember. The Peshitta is the Syriac translation. Now, this was used by especially the Syriac Christian Church, but it's possible that there's significant Jewish influence in that Syriac translation, because after all, Syriac is an ancient language that was a dialect of Aramaic. Most Jewish people in the first century in Palestine, as a first language, would have spoken Aramaic, not Hebrew, and probably not Greek, although it depends on their lineage. But probably they spoke Aramaic, which looks a lot like Hebrew. It's a Semitic language. They use the same character set, but it is a slightly different language. It's the language of the Mesopotamian area, especially of old Babylon. And so that's why they came back from the exile speaking Aramaic. That created problems in the ancient synagogue, okay? I'm going to read you the law. It's in Hebrew. It's kind of like if I got up with you guys and I read you the New Testament in German. Now, English technically is a Germanic language. So technically there should be some connection there. But you guys aren't speaking German. And so it's just going right over your heads, right? Well, that would have been true for a lot of the populace with Hebrew in the reading of Hebrew in the synagogue. So there was an established practice of a person reading the law in Hebrew, and then there being a kind of simultaneous translation into Aramaic. Actually, the way it would go is you'd read the whole passage through in Hebrew, and then the person in Aramaic would produce a paraphrase of it in Aramaic for you guys to understand. The paraphrase could be fairly rigorous and literal translation of the Hebrew into Aramaic, or it could be a little bit more expansive, much more like the Living Bible, for instance, than, say, the New American Standard, something like that. And it could actually be even more expansive than that at times. And so those are known as the Targums, and they're in Aramaic. They're very fascinating because some of them, at least, probably have quite an antiquity and lineage. And they overlap significantly with typical rabbinic teaching in terms of some of the ways that they interpret the Old Testament. Now, moving back up to the Greek, you certainly should know the term Septuagint, because it's used all the time. The Septuagint was a translation that was done a little over 200 years before the New Testament. And strictly speaking, the term Septuagint just refers to the Pentateuch. That's the Pentateuch's first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Right? So, the term came to be applied to the whole of the first major Greek translation of the whole Old Testament. Now, the legends of this are huge, and we actually, the word itself, the Septuagint, reminds us of the legend. The Septuagint, it means the 70. Okay, which is why it's abbreviated LXX, which is the Roman numeral 70, right? You guys remember your Roman numerals? L's 50, add the two X's, add 10, you got 70, right? Stands for the 70. And one of the legends says that Ptolemy in Egypt was collecting a great library, and he heard of the religious writings of the Jewish people, and he wanted to be sure to collect them. So he summoned people from Palestine to come and translate those into Greek so that his people could understand them. And he summoned roughly 70 people, and he put them into 70 different rooms. And over the course of a certain number of days, they all independently translated from one another. And when they were done and they began to compile the 70 different translations, they were all the same. Word for word, the same. Now, that's probably not true. But the legend indicates the high respect that this translation was given, because that could only happen if God ordained it to happen, right? So this was as if a God-ordained Greek translation. Well, this also became the major translation used by the early church. So later in Judaism, after the church was formulated, they became more suspicious of the Septuagint, because that's the Bible of the Christians, right? So there were also other Greek translations that were produced, and they are associated with the names of their translators, Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion. So you should know those terms. And then there's collections of Jewish literature. The Apocrypha is a designation for Old Testament books that are not in the Protestant canon, that are Jewish intertestamental literature. First and Second Maccabees, Judith, Tobit, books like this. So, in short, they're in the Catholic Bible, and they are intertestamental Jewish works, but Protestants don't accept them as canon. And one of the reasons we don't accept them as canon is the Jewish people in the first century didn't accept them as canon. Remember that whole bit, going back to Josephus, about how after Malachi and Haggai and such, there was a cessation of the lineage of the prophets. So although our history has been told, it's not accepted with the same level of authority. That's these books here. Okay. There are other books that are not in the Catholic or Orthodox canon of the Old Testament, but are also Jewish intertestamental writings. And these are known as the pseudepigrapha. Now, the term pseudepigrapha indicates that they are written in the name of somebody else. So I might write in the name of an Old Testament character like Enoch. In point of fact, in modern collections of the pseudepigrapha, they're not all pseudepigraphs. They don't all claim to be written by Enoch or something like that. It's become kind of a convenient designation of the Old Test or of the intertestamental Jewish literature that's not in the Apocrypha. Effectively what the pseudepigrapha is. And then, of course, there's the Dead Sea Scrolls from a variety of locations, including Qumran, but also Murabaot and Nechal Kever, that have come to light in the last 60 years or so. There are specific Jewish authors that have written long pieces. Josephus records the whole history of the Jewish people in his Antiquities, and then also wrote a history of the Jewish war. Philo engaged in allegorical interpretation of the Pentateuch. It's the main thing he did. He did some other stuff too. But he would read the Pentateuch and interpret it as allegory and read into it basically some Greek philosophical terms. And then Pseudo-Philo recounted biblical history in a book that's also known. I'm not as concerned that you know about Pseudo-Philo. The name of his major work is called The Biblical Antiquities. Right? Rabbinic literature can be divided into legal or topical literature, which is Talmudic, and then commentary form literature, which is Midrashic. I think these are written down on your pages there. And I'm not as concerned that you know all of this at this stage. We can perhaps talk about it some more as we go along. But there is the stuff that is topical, the Mishnah being the main compilation, the Tosefta being sort of the additions to the Mishnah, the stuff that didn't make it in the Mishnah, and then the Jerusalem and Babylonian Talmuds being commentaries on the Mishnah. So the Mishnah will codify all of Old Testament law so you know how to keep it. You know when to tithe, how to tithe, all that kind of stuff. And then the Talmuds would comment on that. And then the Midrashic literature would go through different parts of the Old Testament. So the Megillah is on Exodus, the Sifrah is on Leviticus, and the Sifrei is on Numbers and Deuteronomy. And they would go through in canonical order commenting on the text. And the way they would comment is they would quote old rabbinic sayings about that text and string them together. Okay? That's rabbinic literature. So it's good to know something about that. But it's also important to stress that the earliest of these documents is the Mishnah, dated to when?
200,
that's right. Okay. So all of our rabbinic literature is later than the New Testament. Yeah. The Talmuds effectively act as kind of commentaries on the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is a codification of Old Testament law. Okay. I mean, one thing you could do, it wouldn't take you that long, it'd take an hour, go into the reference section of our library, pull a few of these works off, just sample read, maybe 5 minutes in each work, and you could start to get a feel for how these things work. Because it's interesting and illuminating in terms of what Judaism was like in the first century. Okay, we are done then with all of that, finally. Any questions on that stuff while I bring up the next topic of discussion? Yeah. You mean, are there modern-day equivalents to the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes? The Sadducees and Essenes basically died out. The Pharisees, again, it's their legacy that made it into the rabbinic teaching. And rabbinic teaching in the form of the Mishnah and the Talmud is what informs rabbinicism today. No, they wouldn't call themselves Pharisees, but they would see the Pharisees as part of their heritage. Yeah. The question has to do with the translations, effectively, that are being used in a Palestinian context versus an Alexandrian context. Alexandria, everybody's speaking Greek, so you're probably using the Septuagint there. In Palestine, everybody's speaking Aramaic, so you're probably doing something like the Targum practice. It may still be in an oral stage in the first century. People may not be writing down the Targums yet. But the idea of translating from the Hebrew into the Aramaic and paraphrasing in the process is very much in place in Palestine. Probably not being practiced in Alexandria because people don't speak Aramaic.
So could it vary from one synagogue in southern Judea all the way up to another synagogue?
Could it vary is the question in terms of from synagogue to synagogue. I mean, I think the short answer, well, the very short answer is I don't know for sure. I think a more broad answer would be probably to say we probably don't know in general, because we just don't have enough of an information about what went on in different synagogues fully. There were some differences. So the rabbinic documents, such as the Talmud, will indicate that certain practices went on in Judea and different practices went on elsewhere. And so there were some practices that were especially tailored to Judea and not elsewhere. But there was a lot of continuity as far as we can tell. All right. Okay. I want to talk about crucifixion and antiquity in the death of Christ. And the reason is, this class, as we ultimately get into talking about the theology of the New Testament, one of the things we're going to come back to again and again is the death of Jesus and how that was understood. Okay? But in order to understand it, we need to understand it in context. Because crucifixion was something... Well, let me put it this way. Crucifixion today, you guys know, basically, one person who was crucified. One person, Jesus. And you know what crucifixion looks like because you've seen crucifixes or something like it, pictures, right? So therefore, you have in your mind a few things. One is, you know, Jesus is the main crucified guy. We don't think of maybe thousands of people being crucified in our lifetimes, in front of our eyes. We think of one. And we also have a very determined view of what a cross looks like. It's a cross-shaped object like this. Okay? And the person goes up onto the cross wearing a little something around his midriff, you know? And it's very painful and it's bloody. Well, as far as I can tell, the only thing that is definitely true about that always in antiquity was that it was bloody. He was probably naked, for one thing. And secondly, the shape of the cross probably varied in antiquity. And thirdly, there were a lot of people crucified. So our cultural distance from the first century makes it so that we can't perceive of the impact of a church that has to go out and proclaim, hey, I know the Messiah, and by the way, he was crucified. We just don't get the impact of that. So I want to look a little bit at crucifixion in the ancient world. We'll start today, and then we'll finish up next time. Sorry, got the wrong one. Penal suspension in antiquity. What I want to indicate to you is that this idea of hanging somebody up associated with a death is something that lasted for thousands of years and happened for thousands of years before the time of the New Testament. Now, it wasn't necessarily on a cross-shaped object like this, and it wasn't even necessarily the way that you put them to death. They might already be dead, but you would hang them up on an object, and that was the crucial bit. We see this as early in Mesopotamia and old Babylon in the Code of Hammurabi. 2,000 some odd years before Jesus. Okay? And there, if a barber who was kind of the doctor in the ancient world, because barbers had knives, right? And so therefore, if you needed some surgery done, who's got the knives? Well, you go to the barber, right? So you go to the barber. The barber is the one who would take off marks that are in your skin, any tattoos that you had. Well, one of the reasons you tattooed people in antiquity is if you owned a slave, you wanted to make sure that that possession of that slave was marked on their skin. Therefore, if a slave wanted to escape, somebody had to scrape off that tattoo, right? And so you go to the barber to do that. No, that's the context here. So if a barber has excised a slave's mark without the knowledge of his owner so that he cannot be traced, they shall cut off the forehand of that barber. So you have to deal with a barber if he does this. Because this is undermining the whole economic system of Babylon. You got to have slaves. And so if you do something to remove the slaves, you know, that's a problem. Next. If a man is constrained, the barber, and he excises the slave's mark so that he cannot be traced. So I come up to the barber and I say, okay, hey, you gotta take off the mark off of this guy. So I'm the one who's really responsible. The barber doesn't have any option there. So that he cannot be traced. Then they put me to death and they hang me up on the door outside of the house. Okay? And the barber simply has to swear, I excised it unwittingly, and he goes free. So this was such a serious penalty that if I engaged in trying to free slaves, if I became kind of this conduit to freeing slaves in antiquity, they would not just put me to death, but they would hang my body out to be pecked at by birds and to rot out in front of my house. That's what you did. Next. Aside from certain legal context, another time that you would do a penalty like this is in times of war, okay? So here is Tiglath-Pileser III, who was this great Assyrian king, and Assyrian kings loved to boast of their prowess in war, even if, frankly, they weren't even on the battlefield, and it was really their generals that did everything, okay? So here's Tiglath-Pileser boasting, I smashed this city like a pot. Sarabanu, their great royal city, I destroyed, so that it was like ruin left by the flood. I carried off its plunder. Nabu-ushabshi, their king, I hung up in front of the gate of his city on a stake. His land, his wife, his sons, his daughters, his property, the treasury of his palace, I carried off. So you would put the guy to death, you'd hang him up in front of the city and let him rot there. Okay. Here's a picture of what that probably looked like. This is the defeat of Lachish, which was conquered by the Assyrians. And this is a drawing of it. You can see in the lower right-hand corner here, outside the gates of the city, people being led out into exile, and three people being impaled outside the gate of the city. Okay. Now, that's not crucifixion on a cross as you think of it, but it is this idea of penal suspension associated with their death. All right. So you see that going on here. Now, this happens in the Old Testament, and I'll end on this, but this happens in the Old Testament as well. So Joseph, when he's retelling the dreams, or he's telling the meaning of the dreams of the baker and the cupbearer, mentions that the one who's going to get into trouble in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to lift up your head, so probably decapitation, from upon you, and he will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from upon you. So he'll let you decay up on a tree. So this is reported in the Old Testament. It's also constrained in the Mosaic legislation of the Old Testament and associated with God's curse. So in Deuteronomy 21, and when there is in a man a sin bearing a judgment of death, and he is executed, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not spend the night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him in that day, for a curse of God is the one who is hung. And you shall not defile the land which your God, Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. We're going to unpack that a little bit later next time. Let me just point out today that Paul quotes this in the book of Galatians and refers to the curse of God there as the curse that Jesus took on our behalf. So he explicitly associates the death of Jesus and his crucifixion with this Old Testament penalty of suspending a body. And we'll talk more about that next time. So thank you.